last time we spoke about industrialization and how that changed people's lives, the way they work, the food they ate, increasingly bread, potatoes, and tea, as well as how it changed the physical landscape, rural villages of smallholders to polluted cities, and agriculture focused, sometimes disastrously, on a small number of crops. Clearly, the impoverished were not happy about these changes, but others wrote about it as well. So what we'll look at today is the reaction against the Second Agricultural Revolution and against the Industrial Revolution. Or what you might call this lecture, the food Luddites. The Luddites were a people in England who reacted violently against the machines that they believed would take their jobs away, and so they destroy them. In France, they're called saboteurs. They took their sabots, their wooden shoes, and threw them in. But Luddism becomes a general synonym for people who resist technological change and want things to go back to a simpler way of life. Under this rubric, I've included all sorts of people: romantics, vegetarians, health gurus, utopians, and a whole slew of folks who we can vaguely recognize as the ancestors of the modern health food movement. With the increasing stratification of society, lots of different people prone to coalesce into different groups with distinct food ideologies. What all these movements in this lecture have in common is that they are a real 19th century counterculture food movement, like the modern movement, and they eventually, as we'll see, go mainstream, and they are ironically subsumed by the food industry. There are a number of preconditions to these movements that I'd like to start with, and one important factor, I think, here is the almost complete breakdown of basic humoral principles of nutrition in the 18th century. And it began to be replaced, or let's say amended, during the Scientific Revolution, when new chemical ways of thinking, that's with Paracelsus, and new ideas about digestion, and even the idea that digestion was mechanical, those make their way into physiology and replace the Galenic system entirely. And that's a long time. It takes 2,000 years or so. Now, why this is important is without a uniform dietary theory that all physicians subscribe to, there are dozens of different competing theories floating around in the 18th century, each with their own bizarre conceptions of what people need to eat to stay healthy. Some say you have to eat meat, others say drink wine, some say eat vegetables, others say avoid wine. This sounds familiar, I hope. Anyway, in the midst of this wild speculation, there appeared the first scientifically defended vegetarian diets. Philippe Eckey, whose Traité de Ponts du Carême, that means a treatise on Lenten dispensations, in other words, it's about vegetables, in 1709, he argued that digestion is a process of physical grinding of food into a smooth paste, and therefore soft foods such as cooked grains, soft vegetables, are actually the most nutritious, and meat is not because it's too tough. Well, he was soundly attacked by his colleague in Paris, that's Nicolas Andry, and the debate opened this fascinating question, which of course remains to this day. What were we meant to eat biologically, vegetables or meat? A very similar debate took place a few years later in Italy when one Antonio Cocchi argued that we need to measure the weight of food compared to the waste products, including what he called insensible perspiration, to judge which foods are the most thoroughly digested. And in the end, he too favors a vegetable diet, arguing that meat is really too difficult to digest. It causes clogs throughout the system. And with this wild speculation in dietetics, and without one solid set of empirical facts everyone agreed upon, there's a lot of quackery, and almost anything that sounded remotely scientific could pass. And this really was an era of quack diets, when the medical profession did not yet agree on some basic principles like we do today with fats, proteins, carbohydrates, vitamins. There's not a standard body of knowledge then, and that made these so-called natural diets that I'm going to talk about seem pretty legitimate and even scientific. Directly connected to this, oddly enough, are diets that were both scientific and religious. George Shane, in writing in the 18th century, is probably the best example. He promoted a very restricted diet as a way both to lose weight, which is something almost completely new in the dietary literature, and in fact, he himself weighed over 400 pounds, And also as a way to spiritually cleanse the body. In other words, fat was sinful to him, and shedding pounds was sort of like casting off sin and corruption. Now, I bring all of this up because the counterculture diets in the 19th century, like the previous, tended to appeal to a specific kind of person, usually wealthy, overweight, middle and upper class women who wanted to eat a simple diet as a way to lose weight and to become spiritually purified. And I think that's an odd connection that still runs in current modern weight loss programs. Somehow we have this idea that fat is sinful and it's your fault, and only with a kind of religious conversion can you change your life and become thin and, by implication, good and happy. And that's actually true, you could say, of all food ideologies, right? They promise that if you eat a certain way, you will become healthy, moral, politically correct, a better person. And in that way, they're a lot like religions. You know, they require a conversion experience and then a complete commitment. Well, the 18th century weight loss, spiritual renewal diets, do have a direct impact on the 19th century health food movements, because they see industrial society not only as unhealthy, but as morally corrupt. Another thing, which these things are often connected to temperance as well. And alcohol became very inexpensive and really the preferred drink among many poor people, especially gin. And without a doubt, alcohol was one viable escape from the drudgeries of daily life in the industrial era. So these food reformers often mixed in teetotaling with a more simple, natural diet and spiritual revival. And those are, I think, strange bedfellows. Think a Christian movement preaching abstinence from alcohol. What would Jesus have thought about that? You know, even the Puritans had their very strong beer for breakfast, right? And in the U.S., it was actually one ardent Methodist who suggested that grape juice should replace wine as the sacrament. His name was Welch. So if you think about, grape juice as unfermented wine, that's the same guy. So nutritional quackery and religious revival, fat as sin, sometimes alcohol too, those are preconditions to what happens in the 19th century. Another very important thread here, I believe, is the Romantic movement. And here too, the roots are in the 18th century. It began with the Swiss-born philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Now realize that among his contemporaries, the French philosophe, as well as the English, there was this intense faith in progress, in scientific advancement, in economic improvement. Adam Smith is one of them. Well, there was a contest held by the Academy of Dijon in 1750 that asked, has the re-establishment of the arts and sciences contributed to the improvement of our morals? And Rousseau entered the contest with an essay and said, no, they haven't. And progress, he argued, makes us unnatural, lazy, deceitful, and weak. And it's civilization that has ruined us. We're actually good in the state of nature, but things like property and inequality and the ability of one human to exploit another for profit, that has completely corrupted us. It's alienated us from our true good selves. But we are by nature good. It's only when we become civilized that we're selfish and greedy and inhumane and all those other things. Now, Rousseau can be indirectly credited with devising a new attitude toward food as well, which has, I think, long-lasting consequences down to the present. What he is doing is basically worshiping nature. And Rousseau's brand of nature worship inverted the traditional value placed on man-made and improved products, now giving a negative spin on them, on the word artificial. Remember that used to imply artifice, something clever and praiseworthy. Not anymore. And indirectly, Rousseau spawned what we now call a health food movement. Now, simpler foods, those that are unprocessed, unrefined, unspoiled at the hands of overzealous chefs, those are considered preferable. There is a fascinating guide to natural education called Emile, written in 1762, and Rousseau's opening lines are this. He says, "Everything is good as it leaves the hands of the author of things, and everything degenerates in the hands of man." And this includes food. He has his young student, Emil, romping through the fields, eating coarse, ordinary food rather than dainty delicacies. And he quips, "It is only the French who do not know how to eat, since so special an art is required to make dishes edible for them." And he thinks that Europeans increasingly ate deplorable things, too much sugar, pastries, products that are just superfluous, and of course many of them are made using slave labor, and moreover, they're bad for us. Wouldn't it be much better to live on simple bread and cheese like the peasants do? Rousseau also has a decided leaning towards vegetable foods, and he believes that meat eating makes humans more cruel and ferocious. And he scorns his readers. He in fact quotes the Greco-Roman author Plutarch, who says that if you eat meat, you should be willing to kill the animal yourself. I mean, with your own hands, without iron tools, without knives, bite this cow and rip him to pieces. And of course, you know, people need butchers and cooks to sort of hide the horror of murder. And Rousseau basically just wants us to be honest. He says, if you're going to eat meat, understand the consequences. Be honest about it. Rousseau's ideas are especially influential on the romantics of the 19th century. And probably the most important of these is the poet Percy Bysshe Shelley, who became a vegetarian. And in fact, he wrote a little tract about it, A Vindication of Natural Diet. And Shelley, he was a radical democrat, an atheist. He despised oppression and industrial society. He defended the Luddites. He believed in free love and all these other things. But all these concerns over liberty and rights and diet are closely related in his thought. And his vegetarianism seems to genuinely spring from his concern over mistreatment of animals. And remember how intensely they're being raised now. They're being bred for size and carefully fed high-calorie diets, basically just to serve our tastes. And he thought this is just another form of oppression. So this is essentially an animal rights movement. He wrote, "I wish no living thing to suffer pain." He also believed that eating animals was just inefficient. You can get much more food from the land in vegetable form, and that could alleviate much suffering and hunger. Stop wasting pasturage on animals, grow vegetables instead, and there'll be more of it, and it'll be cheaper. So it's a concern, ultimately, for human suffering, too, that is indirectly caused by animal husbandry. Here's a quote. "The quantity of nutritious vegetable matter consumed in fattening the carcass of an ox would afford 10 times the sustenance, undepraving, indeed, and incapable of generating disease, if gathered immediately from the bosom of the earth." And his works were enormously influential. The playwright George Bernard Shaw became a vegetarian. Gandhi was directly influenced by his doctrine of nonviolence. And then the Vegetarian Society was officially founded in 1847. And that's actually when the word came into general use. They remember they were called Pythagoreans before that. What is interesting about them is that they supported their position with the latest scientific findings and with religion. The science comes from the research of Justus von Liebig, probably one of the first people we could call a nutritional scientist in the modern sense of that term. They took his research findings that animal protein is not fundamentally different from vegetable. He sort of extracted glutens from flour, and he says you can really survive on either of them. In fact, Liebig is wrong. The animal proteins have a complete range of amino acids also, and plants don't. But in any case, these people had what they believed to be a scientific defense of the vegetable diet, that you can actually live on it and it's healthy. They also had support from this Swedish Christian philosopher and mystic, Emanuel Swedenborg, who among his 18th century pantheistic ideas believed that meat eating is the most visible symbol of our corruption and fall from grace and the source of evil in the world. And if the peaceable kingdom of Christ after the second coming, this new Jerusalem, will become a reality here on earth, people have to start by giving up flesh. And along with that, they added alcohol, and both, it was believed, caused violence directly. So giving up these foods, again, it's a kind of a spiritual cleansing, if you will. Now, I think the idea that every person and creature contains a spark of divinity must have been very appealing to the down and out factory workers. And those are the people who, for the most part, who joined the Swedenborgian congregations. And it may have attracted them also because they kept soup kitchens. And of course, they served vegetable soup. But it probably wasn't so hard for these people to give up meat anyway, because, you know, they didn't really, you know, they couldn't afford it in the first place. But several of these congregations popped up in the U.S., and some were direct transplants from England. And then there was also an American Vegetarian Society from 1850. But long before the word vegetarian, there was, in effect, a vegetarian cookbook published for these people, written by Mrs. Joseph Brotherton. And she's actually the wife of one of the Vegetarian Society's leaders. That's published in 1821. It was called A New System of Vegetable Cookery. And they were also members of these Swedenborgian-inspired Bible Christian churches. So the book also promotes vegetarianism, abstinence from alcohol, and then mixed into this bizarre melee of ideas was another strand of thought, which is usually called utopianism, or sometimes utopian socialism. That's the term Marx gave these guys as a term of abuse, really. He was implying that they're naive because they're not really revolutionary. But in any case, food reform had always been a major part of utopian thought. Even in Thomas More's Utopia, that's written in the early 16th century, he depicted simple people who lived without property, government, and laws, uncorrupted by civilization, and fundamentally good. But the utopians ate communally. They ate very simple, nutritious meals, and every person took a turn every 2 years at farming. And I think very importantly, they did eat meat, but they made criminals who were forced to become slaves do all the dirty work and to butcher the meat. And Moore believed that getting used to killing animals would sort of desensitize people to killing in general. So he only let the degenerates do it. So, and think also, this is written at the same time as Erasmus's book on manners. So there's a sort of an increasing squeamishness about killing. And that squeamishness reaches its peak in the 19th century, especially as these utopian socialists tried to really create a society based on utopian principles. And remember, Moore never really intended people to live in utopian communities. It was more of a social satire to get Europeans to examine themselves by showing them a pretend pure and simple people. But in the 19th century, there were real utopian experiments. Communes set up in which all the inhabitants would have the same amount of wealth, they would live communally, they would share all the tasks equally. And one of these, an early proponent, was Robert Owen, who took his own money and built this small community in Scotland called New Lanark. And it was basically a textile mill, you know, a factory, except that it was set in this beautiful rural place. It was kept meticulously clean. And the inhabitants lived in tidy houses, the children all went to school, not factories. And I think most important is the workers in the factories had control over how much and what they made. In other words, the assumption is that they would have a pride in their workmanship as an expression of their personal creativity, and they would have the freedom to take ownership of the products because the profits really go back into the community. And Owen's assumption was also that if you put people in decent surroundings and treat them well, they would work hard and succeed and they'd turn out to be good people. In other words, the idea is that the environment makes the person. And of course, he's assuming that you put people in slums and corrupt surroundings, of course they're going to end up alcoholics and committing crimes. Anyway, Owen's community was also supposed to be self-sufficient. So they grew their own food. And as in his original plans, they were supposed to be vegetarian, but that doesn't end up working out in the end. But his food reform ideas did influence this whole generation of people who thought the only way to improve society is to escape, change the nature of work, destroy the inequality between humans, and stop the oppression of animals. And there were many experiments along these lines. A whole slew of utopian socialist experiments happened in the mid-19th century. There were the phalanxes of Charles Fourier. There were communes inspired by Étienne Cabet's book, The Voyage to Icaria, in 1840. And in fact, Cabet founded several communes in the U.S. in the 1850s. None of them in the end could really live up to his ideals. He wanted them to be alcohol free and tobacco free. But what all of these experiments had in common is that they gave up private property. They lived and ate communally. They grew their own food. And often they were so industrious that they could actually sell the excess produce or sell the things that they made. And some of these groups were also quasi or sometimes explicitly religious in nature. The one you're probably most familiar with are called the Shakers. They get that name from the ecstatic worship. The movement itself was founded by Mother Ann Lee, who came to New York from Manchester in England in 1774. And the Shakers set up these communes, starting in upstate New York and into New England. But they spread throughout the Ohio Valley. They go into the South, into Kentucky. And by the mid-19th century, they had something like 5,000 members in a dozen communities. They were surprisingly popular, financially successful. They sold their own jams and herbal teas commercially. And I think the appeal was that they didn't use chemicals or the new artificial fertilizers that were just coming on the market. So their foods got this reputation for being pure and wholesome. They also invented all sorts of things, the wooden clothespin, the apple corer, a revolving oven that could bake many pies at once. And also they invented the flat sewn broom. And if you think, you know, these were meticulously clean people. They'll often have pegs on the walls so you can lift the furniture up and keep it there and then sweep up the floors to keep everything clean. And you've heard the song, right? 'Tis the gift to be simple, you know, and hands to work, hearts to God. But you're probably familiar with the furniture too, this utter simplicity of design and practicality. And the only reason these communities were bound to disappear eventually is the Shakers were also celibate. And men and women, although they lived in absolute equality, they couldn't marry, they couldn't have children, and they lived separately. So they sort of took in new converts and orphans, but eventually they disappeared. And there's in fact only one community left. This is in Sabbath Day Lake in Maine. But the remnants of their community still exist. There's a wonderful museum in New Hampshire, in Canterbury. There are several others, the Hancock Shaker Village in Massachusetts. There is a stunningly beautiful one in Kentucky as well. In any case, do you see how all of these movements are a reaction against mainstream food culture and its ideology of oppression and inequality? And their diet is one facet of a much larger set of ideas for reform. And I think their emphasis on purity of food is in part stimulated. Well, remember the reports of Ackam and all these accusations of food adulteration. So people began to mistrust industrial food. Many of these groups also gave up coffee and tea, because remember, those involve oppression when they're grown. And many also began to eat more raw foods, less processed food. And there's a conscious reaction against mass manufactured food that they believe not only harms your body, but costs you more. So vegetarianism begins to spread. And also the idea that dramatically restricting your diet could improve your health, cleanse your system, cure all sorts of new and fashionable diseases that were ironically brought on by eating too much in the first place. And here's the strangest part of this story. The first anti-modern health food movement began to appeal to wealthy women and men too, as a kind of curative regimen to counteract the rich, heavily meat and alcohol-laden diet that was enjoyed in this period. In other words, they would take vacations to these elite spas and eat vegetables and drink mineral water and, you know, get enemas for a few weeks and massages. I know. In the U.S., we had reformers before, people like Sylvester Graham, the Presbyterian minister who worked in Philadelphia. He railed against bleached flour and artificial leavening and invented the wholemeal Graham flour and the eponymous cracker that we still eat today, Graham crackers, right? A generation later, using Graham's flour, a physician named James C. Jackson developed this hard but quite healthy pure breakfast cereal based on the Graham flour, which he called granula. which is baked in sheets of, and then the flour is broken up and sold in boxes, and then it's so hard, you actually have to soak it in milk before you eat it. But perhaps the most famous or infamous of these religiously inspired health food reform leaders is one Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, whose sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan, offered a curative retreat for the sick and stressed out, and in particular for Seventh-day Adventists. If I'm not mistaken, I think that's the only sect of Christianity that is strictly vegetarian. The leader of the movement, Ellen White, had a revelation in 1863 that meat and artificial stimulants like alcohol and all kinds of impure foods are forbidden. And it had been Adventist policy ever since. And Kellogg was hired and worked at this sanitarium for years, well into the 20th century, in fact. So the topic really goes way beyond where we started, but I think he is the perfect example of how these unusual ideas eventually go mainstream. Well, to start with, Kellogg was a scientist. He was up on the latest science. And it was just at this time that people were beginning to understand the role of intestinal flora in digestion. There are actually bacteria in your gut. You need them to digest your food. And actually, you can kill them accidentally with strong antibiotics. But there are some foods that promote them with things like yogurt, or if you eat live lactobacillus cultures, you're aiding those intestinal flora. Anyway, Kellogg says that people eat too much meat, they don't eat enough vegetables, things which, and the word was just coming into current usage here, things called with roughage, which also promote intestinal flora, as they do in cattle, of course. So he had these visitors to the sanitarium eat very plain vegetables. He cut out all spices and alcohol and other stimulants like coffee. And they were usually patients suffering from stress-related disorders. So the assumption was that these foods all kind of tighten the body and increase stress. But if you switch to plain food, that will relax the sinews. And in 1877, he came up with a cereal, which he called granula. And of course, he was promptly sued by Jackson and forced to change the name to what we all know today as granola. That seems okay. But there's a funny twist to the whole story, too. John was not a good salesman. He never stated one idea long enough to see it succeed, and he was always changing his mind about things or changing formulas or trying out new therapies. Anyway, it took his brother. His brother is Will Keith. He's the WK on the box, right? To figure out how to market granola and another product that he had just developed and patented in 1890s called cornflakes. And Will put these things in nice, neat packages. He paid money to advertise them well, and he began to sell them to everyone, not just, you know, health reform-minded people. He also added sugar to them. He figured people will like that. That's okay. So what began as this strange religious scientific health food cure, because of keen business sense and the fact that they are, in fact, convenient, these products completely changed what Americans eat for breakfast. And Kellogg only had one real serious competitor in these days. It was a product created by a former patient at the Kellogg Sanitarium named Charles W. Post, who invented a coffee substitute made of wheat and molasses. And you can still buy it. It's called Postum. But Post's real success came with another cereal, which he called Grape Nuts. That's 1897, which was advertised as steadying the nerves, making the blood red. And the funniest thing is the name Grape Nuts comes from the barley malt, which converts the starch in the grains into glucose, or as they used to call it, grape sugar. And the final shape of the whole thing, once it's all broken up, of course, looks like nuts, but the product doesn't have grapes or nuts in them. So, in the end, of all strange ironies, health foods originally created in opposition to industrial methods were themselves subsumed as industrial foods. They were mass-produced, they were marketed widely, and they became the very things that had originally been designed to combat. So next time, we will look at another important set of revolutions in consumption, exactly contemporaneous to these, and we will focus on France and fine dining.